From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. Next week marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of one of the most alluring women in the history of film, Marlene Dietrich. Dietrich's cinematic image is composed of multiple, even conflicting personae. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and on this edition of Film Forum, we'll explore the enduring legacy of Marlene Dietrich. How was La Dietrich able to construct her image? She was, over time, a cabaret chanteuse, devoted mother, and icon of lesbian chic. Why does Marlena's image continue to captivate us? That's Odyssey, right after this. From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Marlene Dietrich was born in Berlin on December 26, 1901, 100 years ago next week. Dietrich's persona, one of the most memorable ever to emerge from the cinema, included elements of sex goddess, feminist, lesbian, mother, homemaker, even traitor. She worked hard to create her image and controlled it very carefully. Today on Odyssey's Film Forum, we'll look back at Dietrich's career and the alluring mixture of qualities she projected. We'll find out how she built her image and what Dietrich has meant to different audiences, both here in the United States and in her native Germany. Joining us for the conversation from Dartmouth College in New Hampshire are Mary Desjardins and Amy Lawrence. They are both professors of film and television there. And here in Chicago, we're joined by film scholar Tom Gunning. Tom, let me start with you. Can you begin to describe the image that Marlene Dietrich projected right from the beginning of her career? What were the elements of it?
Well, it's a little tricky because it isn't as though right from the beginning of her career she had this image, because she made a large number of films before she made the film that really made her a star, which is
Blue Angel.
But with the Blue Angel, there was an image that was formed, although it certainly changes and it certainly has modulations. The basics were there. And it's an image that's very difficult to describe because it involves ambiguity. And it partly involves this intense sexuality. And yet at the same time, there's a strange core of indifference in a lot of her attitude. There's a strong sense of manipulation very strongly in the character in the Blue Angel. And yet at the same time, there's strange moments of tenderness. There are strange moments, I don't know if I could quite say of vulnerability, but of some type of personal integrity that even though she's, you know, willing to manipulate people, willing to play games, one really gets the sense that there's some kind of core, at least I do, of authenticity that's kind of hidden back there, and that part of her her whole persona is that she is so carefully prepared as a visual image, so carefully prepared as a performer, so carefully prepared as a woman that men will look at and have fantasies about, that she also seems to have some protected privacy that is exactly what makes her so fascinating, because you don't quite feel that what you see is what you get.
Amy Lawrence, what would you add to that in terms of at least where the image started? We'll talk a bit about how it evolved, but where it started.
Well, I agree very much with Tom that she has this doubleness, this shell or this mask. And often in her earliest sound films especially, for instance, when she's singing her famous songs like Falling in Love Again in Blue Angel, she often has this slight smile on her face, a sparkle in her eye, where she isn't fully invested emotionally in what she's singing or saying or doing, that she's sort of standing back and watching herself perform it and admiring her own performance. So it gives you the option as a viewer to either fully become involved in the story or simply sit back and admire a performer being a virtuoso at what she does.
Mary Desjardins, anything you would add to that? And if not, how careful was she about her image?
Oh, she was very careful about her image. I mean, she saw it as a product. She would call it Dietrich. And she would talk about choices that she would make in her career in terms of, is this good for Dietrich? Meaning, is this good for this persona that has been established, both in her own contribution to that as well as the people she collaborated with. So there are many ways in which she did not change over the years. I mean, I think many of the things that Tom and Amy just talked about in terms of her persona stayed consistent. However, despite that, you know, consistent core, there was this kind of sense that she had the ability to transform herself across different media. She was successful not only in films, but in cabaret performance, on radio, to different audiences, to different generations, to different national contexts. And that's one thing about her, I think, that has allowed her to have a continuing legacy that perhaps some of the stars from that same period don't have.
Tom Gunning, can you talk a bit about her collaboration or her work with Von Sternberg? He was instrumental in, helping her create this person. I don't know what you would call the way they work together.
And it is a difficult thing to define because very often it was described as a kind of Svengali-Trilby relationship. In other words, that Sternberg kind of took this raw material and molded it into something and that she was absolutely hypnotized, absolutely under a spell. However, even if you look at Sternberg's own description of their relationship, it's clear that she was from the beginning a collaborator, that she learned from him rather than that she was molded by him. And one of the main things that she learned from him was that the cinema itself was a creation and that there were all kinds of ways that the camera, lighting, lenses had to be integral to her performance as much as anything that she did physically. And in fact, famous story that, there was a particular lens that Von Sternberg used to shoot her close-ups and that she took that lens and, you know, would give it to cinematographers on every film. In other words, that she would control her image in a technical sense, a very, very modern conception that certainly she partly got from Von Sternberg, but which she understood and made her own.
We should clarify, Von Sternberg is was the director of The Blue Angel, Morocco,
right.
Which other films?
Well, Von Sternberg did her first big star film, even though she'd done films before, in Germany in the early 30s, The Blue Angel, her first sound film as well, then brought her to Hollywood where they did five films together. She did one film with another director in between those, and then said, I'm no longer interested in working with her. I've said everything I have to say about Miss Dietrich, and they parted ways. But those five films are, to my mind, some of the greatest films in American film history and international film history, and they're certainly the films that created the Dietrich persona.
Now, when you say that, and I'd like to hear what all of you think about this, is she, when we talk about the Dietrich persona, is it about the roles, or is it something that kind of transcends the individual stories or settings of these particular films? I mean, you don't think of like, oh, Marlene Dietrich and, you know, she played whoever in this movie. It's sort of like, well, that's a Marlene Dietrich movie. She was just in it being Marlene Dietrich in a sense. She seems less attached to the characters. I shouldn't say the roles. I should say the characters than other actresses seem to be. Is that right?
Well, I think every star, their persona is created out of an interplay between the roles that they play in films, the publicity and promotion that circulated about them. And whatever we might pretend that we think we're glimpsing of the quote-unquote real person. And I think with Dietrich, since she played such similar roles in those Von Sternberg films, that created a kind of core persona for her that, you know, we've been talking about, you know, ways in which she contributed to that she recognized what Von Sternberg could contribute and learn from him in that way. And she continued to do that with other collaborators within the studio system, which helped, I think, her create a kind of consistency that was perhaps even tighter than other stars at that same period. For instance, she worked very closely with Travis Banton, the costume designer. And her work with him made clothes become very important to her persona. And she was able to take that aspect of the persona, the fashionable woman, and play that out outside of the films. And some other stars, something like, if you want to look at Garbo, for instance, she shied away from the public eye when she wasn't in films. And so she, her persona became mysterious to some extent because of that, but she had no interest really in trying to find a persona that could transcend individual films, the way that Dietrich seemed to have recognized that was an important part of her her power.
When we talk about the persona of Marlene Dietrich, it's not just, as you said, it's the interplay between the characters and the off-screen or sort of transcendent set of qualities that we associate with the person. Can you talk a bit, Amy Lawrence, perhaps, about how her publicity machine helped to reinforce these ideas or complement them? I mean, how was she publicized?
Well, when she first would have arrived in Hollywood, it would have been Paramount publicizing her as they did all of their major stars. What's interesting is that when she leaves Paramount, when she starts working solo as an independent, and when she's in her concert career, she has established extraordinary ties with the media in general. She's on the cover of Life magazine perhaps once a year in the 40s and the 50s. People are always interested in her. What she gets paid for her job in Las Vegas made headlines all over the world. The dress that she wore for her opening night, again, her work with costumers, it was a dress that was, some people thought was transparent. It was all beads, and it was like a glacier glinting in the sun, someone said, though her grandson said she looked like a Christmas tree. But she was able to keep herself in the public eye, and because she considered that the performance was not just on stage, but backstage after the show, every time she met a fan, that she had to always, at all times in the public eye, be Dietrich. And she was able to, I think partly through just sort of canny social skills, make contacts with writers and reporters and have them want to write about her, be happy that they're privileged to know her and write about her. Hemingway, for instance, was a very big fan and wrote a special tribute to her in Life magazine. John O'Hara, the novelist, was a very big fan. And so she, and Eric Remarque, the German writer, so she was always in the news, whether she was making films or not. She was always a celebrity. If People magazine existed, she would have been in it every issue.
Tom Gunning, part of the ambiguity or the doubleness of Dietrich's persona had to do with this, the sort of intense sexuality and sexual allure, coupled with this, she came with a daughter, you know, she had a child, she had this sort of very domestic side to her image, and this part of her image that seemed sort of more accessible and more real. And I can't help wondering if you're going to be a movie star and have a successful image, if there has to be that outlet. In other words, does there have to be something that seems a little more touchable to the average people or to an average person in order to make the rest of it work? Do you know what I mean? The bridge between the superstar, the sex goddess, and the rest of the people.
Well, that's certainly true, I think, with all that's the basic attack of star publicity, you know. On the one hand, they're glamorous. On the other hand, they're just folks just like you and I. And most of the fan magazines played those two roles back to back. What is unique about Dietrich, however, within that, is the way that she would kind of juxtapose them rather than mediate between them. So that there is always a sense in a Dietrich film, as you say, I mean, I think it's a really true observation that she's less invested in the characters than in the sense that she's doing a performance. And so in a film like Blonde Venus, which she did with von Sternberg, which was a film kind of inspired by her role as mother in real life and her very strong devotion to her daughter, and in which she plays this woman who is a kind of a German performer who becomes a wife and mother and who's very devoted to her young son, kind of stealing him from her husband when they get divorced. There's this very strong image of her as a mother in that film, and yet there's also this very strong image of her as a cabaret performer. It's the film in which probably, well, she has this famous scene in which she does a kind of striptease out of a gorilla suit, and then, of course, later on appears in Tuxedo and Top Hat, so that her kind of, you know, complete, almost perverse, you know, polysexual, animalistic aspect is there. And yet at the same time, backstage, she has her child. She's taking care of it. And it's almost the contradiction rather than the mediation between the two that causes the kind of tension and interest.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Marlene Dietrich. The 100th anniversary of Dietrich's birth is next week. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey.
I'm Neil Conan. Many of our images of prehistoric life, dinosaurs, mammoths, saber-toothed cats, come from the paintings and drawings of artist Charles Knight. Knight's work also influenced scientists' perceptions of these extinct animals. Join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look at the life and work of Charles Knight, the father of prehistoric art. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That's Talk of the Nation, now at 2, today on WBEZ Chicago. Support for programming on WBEZ is provided by Quad E Donovan Entertainment, presenting the long-running comedy Late Night Catechism, now playing weekends at the Royal George Theater. Ticket information at 312-988-9000 or through Ticketmaster. You're listening to WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio.
Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. It's Film Forum here on the program, and we're talking about Marlene Dietrich. The 100th anniversary of Dietrich's birth is next week. We're joined by Mary Desjardins, who teaches in the Film and Television and Women's Studies departments at Dartmouth. Her forthcoming book is Recycled Stars, Hollywood Film Stardom in the Age of Television and Video. We're also joined by Tom Gunning, who teaches Cinema and Media Studies and Art History at the University of Chicago. Tom's latest book is The Films of Fritz Lang, Allegories of Vision and Modernity. And we're talking with Amy Lawrence. Lawrence also teaches film and television at Dartmouth and has written extensively on the use of women's voices in cinema. Amy Lawrence, let's begin to talk, if we can, about Dietrich's voice, because her control over her image also included skillful deployment of visual and audio elements.
Yes, she was very, from the very beginning when she auditioned for The Blue Angel, it's a screen test that had relatively recently been rediscovered, and in it she sings in English, and then she gets very angry with the piano player so she can show her dominatrix side, and berates him in German, so we can see her acting, we can see her range, but we can also see her linguistic skills, and we can see that she could sing. And so from her very first sound film, singing was part of her persona. It was something that she could bring to the Garbo international femme fatale figure that Garbo couldn't do. And her singing has different effects on different people. Some audiences, particularly a German audience, finds her singing to be more intimate, more authentic, more personally connected to their own experience. Hemingway, for instance, wrote that if she had nothing more than her voice, she could break your heart with it, which is a rather sentimental view that Dietrich doesn't usually evoke. Other people said that it's part of her typical image. Kenneth Tynan, for instance, said that she was a Venus in furs with black leather in her voice.
Well, you know what? Let's hear a little bit of Marlene Dietrich singing. We'll see if we can hear the furs or the black leather. This is Dietrich singing Falling in Love Again. This is from a recording from the early 1950s.
Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it. Love's always been my game. Play it how I may. I was made that way. I can't help it. Men cluster to me like moths around a flame, and if their wings burn, I know I'm not to blame. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
Well, you can almost hear the whip crack there in the background, can't you?
That's wonderful.
Amy Lawrence, as time went by and Dietrich got older and was less flattered by the camera than perhaps she had been in her younger days, she continued to use her voice to sort of maintain that alluring, to keep visual images of herself away, but still put herself out there through her voice?
Well, the images were still of her performing in her skin-tight, transparent dresses in Vegas, but at a distance, sort of her whole body, not just the big close-ups of the von Sternberg years. And the singing, one person said that you couldn't describe it in octaves, whether she's a great singer or not. She never strains for high notes. And, of course, in the Dietrich style, she never strains at all. And in that way, she's the antithesis of someone like Judy Garland, who is expressing the depths of her soul and who will contort her entire body and her face to express powerful emotion. Whereas Dietrich, you get the feeling that often she doesn't, she chooses a song that won't require her to move her face much so that she can always look beautiful. And Burt Bacharach, who worked with her as her the conductor of the orchestra during her touring years, said that in the dozen years he worked with her, she never changed a single note. So again, she's got absolute discipline. She sings the same songs for generations. When you said the Falling in Love Again was from the 50s, it could have been the 30s, it could have been the 70s. She never changed it. She knew her effects. She got those effects. And it's part of her skill as a performer.
Mary Desjardins, let's talk a bit about the doubleness of her sexual persona. She was perceived not just as sexually alluring to men, but to women also.
Yes.
Has become this important gay icon or lesbian or bisexual icon. But also, there was a certain sort of feminism in the fact that she was wearing men's clothes and, yes. and you know, making different sorts of claims. Does that part of her persona have a trajectory from when she started doing this in the 30s to what it might mean when Madonna makes a reference to Dietrich now?
Well, I think one thing we need to remember is that her earliest performing experience came out of Weimar Germany and cabaret and stage work, which was a milieu in which ambivalent sexuality, polyvalent sexuality, was very much out in the open. And it was, to some extent, you could say, fashionable, but also there was some political charge behind this as well. She absorbed that. From what we understand about her private life, she experienced sexuality in all of its various permutations, though she never really identified herself as being gay or straight. And it's unlikely that any performer from that period would, but one of the things I think that's very interesting about her sexuality is, to some extent, it defies certain categorizations that not only make sense sort of historically in terms of her coming out of that 20s Germany scene, but in ways that make her very fresh for us today and perhaps make her attractive to someone like Madonna, where to be labeled one thing or another could actually be harmful to your career and could cut off potentially some form of your audience, your constituents. And whether Dietrich knew this consciously or whether it was, again, you know, something that she absorbed from her milieu, something that came from some, you know, personal side, I don't know, but it was something that worked for her throughout most of her career, of having that polyvalent imagery. And I think it's possible to see her in some ways, again, not necessarily politically as a feminist icon, but as a woman who knew her own power and exploited her power to get something that she wanted, and that power has a legacy today that you know, women see her as someone that's possible to emulate in terms of having that kind of confidence.
It's interesting that Mary Desjardins would say that there are parts of her persona that defy categorization, because what I was going to ask, actually, was whether Dietrich had some role in creating possible categories, mm-hmm. sexual mm-hmm. categories, female mm-hmm. categories, that are, you know, still in use or still meaningful. Tom Gunning?
Well, one of the key things, I think, that one has to say is this idea of construction. Something that she took very seriously. It was both her work, it was her aesthetic, but it was also her persona. It was something that she showed in a certain way. And the idea of femininity as a masquerade, as something that's put on for men, that women are perhaps not essentially feminine, but rather that it's a construction, and that it's a construction that's geared in relationships to the unequal powers between men and women. These are things that are constantly being worked out in the plots, particularly of her von Sternberg films, and in her performances. I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about, say, for instance, a film she did with von Sternberg called Dishonored, which is a spy film kind of based on Mata Hari from the early 30s, is that as a spy, she plays all these different roles. You know, she can be a femme fatale with feathers, or she can be a kind of German, barmaid who's a peasant. You know, that she can pick up or drop these personas in an instant. That is, in fact, her skill. Her skill is as a performer who can be anything you want, who, in fact, is manipulating you by perceiving your own desires and working into them. And
her characters are often performers, singers,
exactly,
or actresses.
Exactly,
or...
right. And that you can never tell what her desire is.
Right.
There's a wonderful moment, and it has to do with her acting and her voice, in Dishonored, where she's let another spy, a Russian spy, she's a spy for the Germans, go. And there's an indication that she's in love with him, but it's not explicit. And they ask her in a trial, why did you let him go? And she says, and I wish I could do the voice, but I'll do the close approximation, perhaps because I loved him? You know, and it is even in her own voice a question. So we never know. Is she ironically saying, you know, why does a spy let another spy go? It must be because I'm a woman in love. Whereas it could be for a totally different reason.
Mm-hmm. Tom Gunning teaches cinema and media studies and art history at the University of Chicago. We're talking today about Marlena Dietrich, and we'll take some phone calls later on in the program. Our number is 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. That's toll-free anywhere in the United States. We're also talking with Mary Desjardins, who teaches in the film and television and the women's studies departments at Dartmouth. Her forthcoming book is Recycled Stars, Hollywood Film Stardom in the Age of Television and Video. And Amy Lawrence, who also teaches in film and television and women's studies at Dartmouth and has written on the use of women's voices in cinema. Amy Lawrence and Mary Desjardins, actually this question is for both of you because Dietrich seems to have this almost like post-mortem biography. You know, she has this, her image and her sound have this life that goes on in the way people appropriate her, you know, and make use of her image. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that, the different various groups that have sort of taken up Dietrich as a banner.
Well, one thing I find fascinating is that not only does she appeal to a lesbian audience, but also to a gay male audience. And it's rare that you have a figure who appeals to both of those groups. And listening to her sing, I was thinking Dietrich is the first great Dietrich impersonator, that she knows what the pre-established icon is, and then she measures up to it. And a lot of impersonation of her, usually you assume that the impersonator is going to be a man impersonating Dietrich rather than a woman. And so she plays with, as Tom said, femininity as masquerade, sexuality, identity, everything as a performance. And so she's very, very good at that. And this leaves her, of course, wide open to appropriation by many groups, heterosexual men who think she's sexy, women who admire her confidence, gay men who admire her confidence and her freedom with gender, lesbian women, etc. So she's got a very wide group to appeal to. Also, another of the skills that she had before she ever met von Sternberg was her ability to switch languages, which also makes national identity something that's up for grabs. She's obviously always German, but she also speaks English fluently. She's identified in many biographies as an American star. She became an American citizen in 37. She very famously supported the war and toured for the troops during World War II. And she was equally fluent in French and lived the latter part of her life in Paris. So her linguistic identity was something that also was very fluid. And in all of these countries, people have they feel they have the real Dietrich. They have a different access to her.
Well, I have a couple questions about that, and I'm not sure who would be able to answer them, so let me throw them out there. One is, at least for the American audiences, does her foreignness sort of open up space for that ambiguity? I mean, does all of this masquerade and all of this performance and elusiveness work better because she's foreign, because she speaks with an accent, because she sings in foreign languages, in a way that might not have operated so well had she been American? Tom Gunning?
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. It's a very interesting thing to read the fan magazines when Dietrich first appears in the early 30s. And they're identifying and contrasting her with Garbo. And both of them have this quality that they see is very different from the American movie star, which is what they call glamour, which is this kind of sophistication. And it's essential that there's a foreignness there that it's not seen as all-American. It's not Mary Pickford. It's not Lillian Gish, who had been stars in the 20s. And it's a different atmosphere. And again, it often, you know, in the 30s, she often had trouble because there was, with the Depression and a kind of sense of, you know, getting down to everyday life, actresses like Claudette Colbert, even though she actually had a French background, seemed to be more American, more down to earth. And there were certain people, I think, who also saw it as a kind of problem that she was foreign. But it certainly is part of the distance, the glamour, the kind of sense of inaccessibility that she has.
Who were some of her other American contemporaries? I mean, what other leading ladies and female personae were there on the screen when she was making films with von Sternberg, that era?
Well, there would be a number of people. I mean, this would be around the time that both Bette Davis and Joan Crawford are beginning to emerge as major stars. Of course, it's curious because very often the major stars are people we don't think of so much anymore. Norma Shearer, who was kind of sophisticated American social woman, society woman type, was probably, someone that she was often compared to and contrasted with.
Katharine Hepburn comes along about 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Katharine Hepburn would, along with Dietrich, promote the wearing of trousers. They would both of those things would be cemented with their images for both stars.
Amy Lawrence, anyone else? This is also the Barbara Stanwyck era.
Yes, definitely Barbara Stanwyck in maternal melodramas of the period that Blonde Venus is very close to.
She's one of my favorites. I like to get her in whenever possible.
Yes. Absolutely. I was thinking her. And other foreign stars like Anna Sten, people who they tried to promote. Louise Rainer, who won 2 Oscars and then sort of disappeared. People who they tried to promote as more foreign stars. What I find interesting about Dietrich's foreignness is that when she comes to Hollywood, although we always think of her as a German actress, that she almost hardly ever in the 30s plays a German character. She plays French characters, Russian characters, gypsies, Mexicans. She can play anything, but she's almost never German until after the war in things like Foreign Affair and Judgment at Nuremberg, where being German is a political issue.
Let's talk a bit actually about that, because her reception in Germany has been mixed over the years. Different generations of Germans have different responses to Marlene Dietrich, in part because of her activities during the war. She was seen by some as anti-German when she worked for the Allies.
Well, in many ways, if you think about what Hitler hated, it was the Weimar Republic, the Weimar gender bending, the kind of what he saw as, you know, un-German qualities that Dietrich would be a kind of almost poster child for. So that under the Nazis, it's very interesting because you have a figure that's kind of a parallel and an interesting contrast, which is Zara Leander, who's actually a Swedish woman who has a beautiful, what the Germans call dunkel voice, dark voice. Like Dietrich's, only she can really sing, and who's a great star.
I'm glad you said that, not me.
In the 30s and early 40s, but who has this much more wholesome persona, even though she's got this masculine voice, and she does in fact have a strong gay following in Germany. Her image is as a good, you know, kind of Hausfrau in most of those films, with a couple exceptions. Then, of course, after the war, I mean, there is a way that her entertaining for the American troops is seen as a betrayal for many Germans. And there, I think it's actually a kind of what, projection of their own guilt, you know, onto to someone who didn't have to suffer through both the war and the Nazi era, kind of saying, well, you know, she's morally superior, but she didn't have to go through it.
When Dietrich toured in Germany in 1960, when she toured with her cabaret performance in Germany in 1960, there was an incident in which a woman quite publicly pulled Dietrich aside, pulled her fur coat, pulled her aside and spit in her face. And Dietrich was very disheartened by this, not only because it was humiliating in public, but it also made her feel that she probably could never go back there to live again.
Well, but now there's a Marlene Dietrich Platz in Berlin. There's a whole Dietrich wing of this new German film museum. They seem to have come around, I guess.
Well, at least there's some portion of the German public that do want to claim Dietrich.
Well, let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Marlene Dietrich with some phone calls at 1-888-859-1800. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey.
Better Today on This American Life, an all-black congregation in East Tennessee that's used to sounding like this in church, gets a white minister who acts the same way he did in front of a white congregation. He's more reserved. He writes his sermons down.
And he was preaching? And I thought, what on earth is he talking about?
Why they've kept him 15 years and other stories of faith on This American Life. It's tonight at 7, tomorrow at 1 o'clock on Chicago Public Radio.
Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, offering a large selection of loose diamonds, custom mountings, jewelry, and watches, now open in Aurora, Skokie, Orland Park, and St. Charles. You're listening to WBEZ Chicago, 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio.
Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and today on the program, it's Film Forum, and we're talking about Marlene Dietrich. The 100th anniversary of Dietrich's birth is next week. We're joined by Amy Lawrence and Mary Desjardins, who both teach in the Departments of Film and Television and Women's Studies at Dartmouth College. And here in Chicago, we're joined by Tom Gunning, who teaches Cinema and Media Studies and Art History at the University of Chicago. Our phone number, if you'd like to join in our conversation, is 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Marita. Hello, Marita. You're on Odyssey.
Well, hello, good morning. I am actually from Berlin, and I am the generation in between. I was born in 38. And I just wanted to say that the older generation, it's not me, but kind of my mother's generation, they don't appreciate Marlene Dietrich too much because she denounced Germany. And like you mentioned in your program, she went to America, made money where they were suffering, you know, and they were not all part of the regime. And I think when she came to Berlin to try and have a comeback during her performance, she was thrown, bombarded with eggs or something. Mm-hmm. I remember that from my mom.
What do you think? What about people from your generation? What's the attitude
towards
Dietrich?
Well, my generation is in between, and I do know that the younger generation now glorifies her, but I think it's part of the media, too. They're not as critical. And people who are living in a satisfied economy are not as critical. You know, you'll always find politics is more discussed when there is a little downturn. And I think that's part of it. Also, Germans are not as nostalgic as Americans, I have found, living in this country. You know, you still celebrate people because they've had a good name.
Mm-hmm.
We don't.
Mary Desjardins, what do you think about that?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting in terms of what the caller said about Dietrich going to Hollywood and making lots of money and that being a possible opening for certain level of resentment against Dietrich. This was something that the studio system had to negotiate constantly, even in the American context. Stars were making more money than anyone else was in the Depression, or very few people. And there was always this potential for the public to not only want to perhaps adore and emulate stars, but also to resent them for having certain kinds of things that people didn't have at that time. And it's interesting, I'd never really thought of Dietrich fitting in to that paradigm, but I guess she would, perhaps in ways that were perhaps even more severe than they would have been in the United States, in that you have a country in Germany between World War I and World War II that are suffering greatly, economic deprivation, rapid political changes. And so that Dietrich would become a figure of resentment just for that alone. But then on top of that, when you have this politically charged situation in which she publicly refuses the Nazi regime's attempt to bring her back to Germany to make films, staying with Hollywood, working with Jews, many Jewish directors and producers, and of course, that kind of propaganda would circulate in Germany at that time, that Hollywood was controlled by Jewish interests. So you have a very charged situation that makes Dietrich perhaps an exemplary figure in this regard, in terms of there being perhaps a large portion of one national context that have these feelings towards her.
Mm-hmm. I'd also like to say that she, one of the her war work is very much an important part of her image and her myth, and it seems to be the one time in her life when she's not doing something that has a doubleness, or that she's not indifferent to or outside watching, but that she's fully emotionally invested. And this is the real Dietrich. And it's when she's entertaining the troops, and she's not only singing for the Americans, but also the OSS, the forerunners of the CIA, had her broadcast to German soldiers in German, trying to sort of woo them toward a warmer feeling toward the Americans when the Americans were going to win the war. And so they were using her as an ambassador to try to weaken German morale and woo enemy soldiers over to the American side. So she was very, very active, absolutely unconflicted about her opposition to Hitler throughout the 30s. And so it's seen as one of the authentic elements of her, of who she really was, is mm-hmm. her opposition to fascism.
Let's take another phone call. Our number is 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Lois. Hello, Lois. You're on Odyssey.
Hello. Good afternoon to all your guests. I'd like to ask the panel a simple question. What they think of the movie Witness for the Prosecution? Because I like the movie, but I just can't see Marlene Dietrich wimping out for Tyrone Power. I just wonder what you thought.
Well, it's an interesting question, because I think there are a group of Dietrich fans who love her performance in that and who feel that she should have won the Academy Award for it. In fact, Maximilian Schell, in the film that he made on Marlene Dietrich, which is called Marlene, makes this point, and it's clear that that's his favorite film. To me, I agree with you. It's an artificial performance. It doesn't have the ambiguity. It doesn't have the sense of humor that she has. I mean, she's working with Billy Wilder there, and I think she's much better in Billy Wilder's Foreign Affair, where she has all plays with her persona and has all her cynicism and all her sense of humor. It's certainly a technically proficient performance, and I wouldn't want to put it down, but I agree, it's not for me what I would want to remember her as.
It seems to work right up until the very end. You know, she sort of disappoints you at the very end and needs one more twist, and then you would stay with it. But she sort of takes the easy way out or something.
Well, I think it's hard to see Dietrich as vulnerable to anyone. I mean, she's vulnerable to the love that she has for Tyrone Power, but it being Tyrone Power, and I think he's probably a star that has not survived very well historically in terms of there being contemporary interest in him. So I think it's hard for us to see that film today and think that she would risk what she risks for, of all people, Tyrone Power.
Yes, it's a Tyrone Power problem, not a Marlene problem.
That's right.
Although, let me just put in, I basically agree, but Tyrone Power in Nightmare Alley gives one of the
greatest. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. When his prettiness had started to fade, absolutely.
But when Marlene sacrifices herself for Gary Cooper in Morocco or for Jimmy Stewart in Destry Rides Again, no problem whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But Tyrone Power, I'm sorry, not Ben.
Yeah, he's too slimy, and she seems too smart at the beginning of that movie to fall for it.
Yeah.
All right, let's take another call. Let's talk with Tom. Hello, Tom. You're on Odyssey. Tom? Okay, let's take another call. Let's talk with Inga. Hello, Inga. You're on Odyssey.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling actually in regards to this caller a couple of calls back about Germany. I, too, am from Germany. And as far as I'm concerned, the fact that she stood up to Hitler and virtually told them to go to hell, she'll be a hero in my eyes forever. I mean, and I think that the generation now, where they're building things and naming things for her, are probably thinking that way too. Because after all...
Mm-hmm. Tom?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and that there is this kind of rediscovery also of the Weimar culture in Germany in a contemporaneous context.
Let's take another phone call, 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Jan. Hello, Jan. You're on Odyssey.
Yes, I just, first let me just make it clear, I have no affiliation whatsoever with Turner Classic Movies, but I'm a great Dietrich fan, and I just wanted to let all your listeners know that they're really rolling out all the stops. on her birthday, they're showing a couple of her best films, including my personal favorite, which is Blonde Venus, and also a new film that they've made, a documentary. But in January, they're showing 21 films, including Dishonored, which was previously mentioned by Tom Gunning, and a lot of other things on that list that are pretty hard to see. So all Dietrich fans that are wondering, or people who are wondering about her mystique, have a real good opportunity to see a lot of her films if they get cable.
Are her films difficult to see in general, Tom?
Well, I think there may be a few. The vagaries of what go in and out of video, it's always hard to predict. I think most of the von Sternberg classics are available. There are films that I know I've had some trouble tracking down at points. It was a long time before I got to see the film that she made in between her various von Sternberg films, Song of Songs by Ruben Mamoulian. And I don't know if that's readily available, but I have to admit, I kind of hate watching films and videos, so I kind of wait until they're going to be shown someplace in 35mm.
And be forewarned that Blue Angel is also the title of a porn film, and you don't want to accidentally rent that one. I learned that the hard way, so to speak. Our phone number is 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Helen. Hello, Helen. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. I'm calling my car, so it's probably kind of panicky. I just want to tell you about this wonderful new book that's just out from Knopf. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a beautiful picture book and word documents, letters based on the museum in Germany, the Marlene Dietrich Museum, and it's just stunning. It would make a fabulous gift for Christmas. I just got it. But it has all kinds of letters. It was put together by her daughter, I think. What's her name? Maria Rivas?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anyway, it's beautiful. I don't know, has your panel seen it?
I think someone is giving it to me for Christmas. I have it on good authority.
Her daughter wrote a pretty comprehensive biography.
Yes.
That I think is pretty well regarded. I mean, it's not a Mommy Dearest or anything like that. It's
right.
A real biography.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's well written or well edited. I don't know which, but and very balanced. I mean, one definitely feels the painful aspects that she went through with her famous mother, but also her devotion, and it gives a very interesting view of her career.
One of the things that's remarkable about that book is the level of detail that it has. Most star biographies, whether they're autobiographies or biographies, skimp on the details, so especially details of making films. And Maria Riva, as a child, was taken to the studio by her mother and witnessed her mother putting on makeup, getting the costumes going, being on the set. And either she has a very good memory or some novelistic skills in which she's able to recreate that scene. But it really is wonderful in that regard in terms of the very strong details.
We've just got a few minutes left, but I'd like to hear what each of you think about, here we are at the 100th anniversary of Marlene Dietrich's birth. Her films are now available to be seen by, generations who would have had no contact with her, but now we have video, and so she can continue. We can continue to see the films, continue to consume these images. Maybe this is a weird question, but how long can a persona last? Tom Gunning?
Oh, well, I mean, I think very long. Obviously there are all kinds of figures from history that we don't have the kind of photographic or moving picture access to, but figures that become, in effect, myths, Shakespeare, any number of people who can stand in for their art. And I think one of the things that was said about Dietrich fairly early on, André Malraux, I think, said it, is that she's not a woman. This was while she was still alive. He said she's not a woman, she's a myth.
Mm.
And that a myth, by definition, lasts forever.
Tom Gunning teaches cinema and media studies and art history at the University of Chicago. His most recent book is The Films of Fritz Lang, Allegories of Vision and Modernity. Amy Lawrence, what do you think about the persistence of Dietrich's image, and can it continue to function the way it has functioned?
Well, part of the persistence of her image is that how it functions changes, and different audiences come along and pick it up. As one of the callers said, there's a younger generation in Germany that has a different relationship to her than the last generation or the previous generation. And so as long as new audiences that we can't even predict who can pick up something that they can use, that they can relate to and respond to, she's going to keep working. If she becomes old-fashioned and sort of fades out, then that will be the end of it. Though I do also want to put in a plug for Turner Classic Movies. It's fabulous to see the beautiful prints they show, and they really do keep these images in circulation so they can be discovered by new audiences.
Amy Lawrence teaches film and television and women's studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Mary Desjardins, your book, Recycled Stars, Hollywood Film Stardom in the Age of Television and Video. You must have something to say about Dietrich Stardom as she is now, you know, now entirely a creature of recycling.
Right. Well, I would agree with both of the other panelists, and they said it beautifully. I have written on an experimental video that was made by a Latin American video maker named Cecilia Barriga called Meeting Two Queens. And this very short video, 15 minutes long, takes images of Dietrich from her films and juxtaposes them, re-edits them with images of Garbo from her films. And they're edited in a way to suggest that the two women are having a relationship with one another. But they're also edited in a way to sort of celebrate the glamorous, mysterious personas of these Hollywood stars. And I show this video in star classes that I teach, classes on stardom and celebrity and fandom. And in many cases, the students have never seen a film with Garbo or with Dietrich. And yet they respond to these images. They've come to stand in a sense, for something about beauty, something about Hollywood and its power to be able to circulate and keep recycling certain kinds of images. They, of course, in this particular video, stand out as something, saying something particular to a lesbian and bisexual audience, too. And this is an audience that is very hungry for images, positive images, from mainstream media to be able to claim as you know, part of their own heritage. So I think there's all kinds of ways that stars can be recycled, and Dietrich has been up there with the best of them in terms of having that longevity.
Mary Desjardins teaches in the Film and Television and Women's Studies departments at Dartmouth. Her forthcoming book is Recycled Stars, Hollywood Film Stardom in the Age of Television and Video. Mary Desjardins, Amy Lawrence, and Tom Gunning, thank you all very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio. Our technical producer is Steve Warnauskas. Our associate producer is Allison Cuddy. And our senior producer is Joshua Andrews. Edward Lifson is the managing producer of our program. Our theme song was composed and performed by the Chicago band OK Go. General manager of Chicago Public Radio is Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you've been listening to Odyssey.